Welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Information continues to emerge from Florida about what the disputed ballots in various counties reveal. The latest word is that George W. Bush would have retained his lead even after counting the so-called undervote in four contested counties. For some people, the Florida issue will never be settled because votes that they consider legal and valid were not included in the final official tally. It hardly seems surprising that strong feelings would emerge about votes. The right to vote is seen as a sort of bottom line measure of democracy and central, at least to our democratic process. The way we view voting now, though, is not the way it's always been. Aside from the well-known fact that suffrage was far from universal when the nation was founded, the place of voting within the concept of democratic self-government has evolved a great deal in our history and has meant different things to different people at different times. Today on the program, we're going to explore this history a little bit and the road that the franchise has traveled over 2.25 centuries. And we are joined by Richard John, who is Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the author of Spreading the News, the American Postal System. From Franklin to Morse. We're also joined by Alex Kasar, who's professor of history and public policy at Duke University and the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in America. And we're joined by Barack Obama, who is Illinois State Senator from the 13th District and a senior lecturer in the law school at the University of Chicago. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning.
Good morning, Gretchen.
Maybe we could begin kind of by puncturing a few myths about voting, or maybe not myths, but sort of not well understood facts about voting historically. Alex Kasar, I'm going to start with you, because in your book, The Right to Vote, one of the things that you're interested in addressing is the idea, the misunderstanding that the right to vote has sort of steadily expanded, or suffrage has steadily progressed towards universal over the course of our history. But that's not really true, is it?
No, it isn't. And actually, I think that was one of the real surprises when I was researching the book, because as you mentioned in your introduction, a lot of people are aware that suffrage was far from universal at the beginning of the country's history. But we have this happy image of, well, it just got broader and better all the time. But there are countless examples of people losing the right to vote. In the first half of the 19th century, for example, African Americans in many northern states lost the right to vote. I argue in the book that, in fact, the entire long period from about the 1850s to World War I was a period when the right to vote contracted, when not only African Americans in the South, but immigrant workers in the North, in many different ways, lost the right to vote. In the 1930s, there were attempts to take the vote away from people who were unemployed. And one could even find in the last election, on one of the remaining and quite controversial issues, which is the disfranchisement of felons, Massachusetts, which had never disfranchised felons in the course of the last 200 years, voted to do so last November. So it's not steady progress. It's a very up and down and conflicted process.
Well, let's go back. I might jump around through time here a little bit, but let's go back to the founding of the Republic, the early days. And what I'd like to know about is not who was voting. I think people have a pretty good handle on that. But what I'd like to know is how is the act of voting understood? What is it that people understood themselves to be doing when they voted? Was it the same as what we think of ourselves doing today? Richard John, maybe you can talk about that.
Well, no, it was really quite different. The founders' conception of suffrage was predicated on the assumption that the individuals who have the right to vote are those who are propertied or have a certain amount of independence and therefore have a stake in society. And they were less choosing specific policies than they were choosing men, and of course all the representatives were presumed to be men, who would then stand for them and exercise independent judgment. It wasn't even understood that these men, representatives, would be members of political parties. Political parties were abhorred by the founders. And it was not even understood that the citizenry would follow the deliberations of Congress, national legislature, sort of week to week, as many Americans do today. That is to say, there was not an assumption that the press would be a vital role in the perpetuation of liberty. So the press and political parties, two things that we take really very much for granted as the meat of our political system were somewhat outside of the kind of intellectual universe of our founders.
So would you say that at the time of the founding, the main function that voting accomplished was the function of establishing representation rather than deciding policy or choosing a course? It was about saying, this is the person who best represents me.
I think that's right. A very wise historian once said that the citizenry was supposed to be able to detect tyrants. They were supposed to be able to know who they didn't want to represent them. But the details of public policy and legislation were not to be the voter's primary responsibility. You didn't carry around with you checklists of where your representative stood on this, that, or the other issue. Now, this would change over the course of time, but I think it's important to at least have a baseline as to what the founders understood. And, of course, the founders never thought that presidential elections would be routinely decided by the electorate. Either they assumed that it would be decided by the House of Representatives, which is, turns out, not a very good way to do it.
All right, let's begin to talk about how that original conception begins to evolve. What sorts of changes emerge? You've hinted at some of them, Richard John. The emergence of political parties, the almost immediate emergence of communication following the establishment of government. What are some of the other major steps in terms of changing what not just who voted, but what voters were expected to do and understood themselves to do?
Well, as suffrage increased, I think, Alex, you'd agree with me that there is an increase in suffrage in the first half of the 19th century.
Yes,
perhaps it was inadvertent. It was not the heroic narrative that we think of it to be. But as suffrage increased, politicians, those desiring to get elected, had to find new mechanisms really to get voters interested in what it was they were about. And it was at this time we have the emergence of organized political parties, and we have a broadening in the kinds of appeals that politicians would make. So they begin to play on ethnic and religious and all sorts of cultural themes that leads to the establishment of what we call army politics, where you march your legions to the polls in the 19th century. And perhaps just another basic fact about voting that may not be self-evident to all of our listeners. I know it was a surprise to me when I started looking into the subject, was, of course, voting was open. You knew who voted for who, and you would march to the polls in a group. And in so doing, you would be announcing to your neighbors, your friends, and sometimes even to the officials who were at the polling place, who you stood for. And I think that made quite a that made voting into quite a different sort of experience than it has since become. The polling place was not this confessional where you would go and commune, perhaps clutching the Chicago Tribune to help you figuring out which judges you wanted to get rid of, but it was instead a collective, almost a cell. It was more like a sporting event or some kind of civic ritual, like popular culture. I wonder, Alex, is that congruent with your thoughts on the history of the right to vote?
Well, I think the evolution of the right to vote accompanies that. I mean, I think that is there. There certainly is that growth of voting as spectacle and that, you know, and as team sports. Mm-hmm. I think I agree with you absolutely about that. Indeed, one concrete fact, which I think may be of interest, is that even as places move towards written ballots, the first written ballots were in fact, you know, not prepared by the state or by a township or whatever. They were prepared by the parties. The party gave you the ballot, and that's what you turned in. And often parties had distinctively colored ballots so that it was quite clear who you were voting for.
I want to turn the conversation to the question that I think that one of the ideas about voting that's around now is the idea that the right to vote is sort of a minimal definition of who's in the community, who's in the political community, and who's not. Sort of the extension of democracy extends as far as suffrage does, which wasn't. I wonder if that relationship is always held, even when, whether the line of suffrage meant that everyone who didn't vote was excluded from the community, or whether the community was organized differently, and how it might have attained this meaning. Barack Obama, maybe I'll throw that one to you.
Well, I think your question goes to who was actually able to vote and who wasn't. You've already mentioned, and I think that most of your listeners are aware, that not only were persons of African descent not able to vote at the time, but you also have most prominently women, unable to vote at the time. You also have property restrictions on who's able to vote on the time. All those people are considered to be part of the community and are considered potentially the subject of regard for the elites that have been selected to represent those communities. But there's not that connection of voter to representative for those persons that was available to a relatively narrow band of people. And I think that both Richard and Alex have done an excellent job giving you some flavor of the evolution during this early period of how people start to feel that their participation in the voting process is not simply a question of selecting an elite, but over time what you see is an evolution where they see this as part and parcel of a broader civic engagement and a greater ownership over the political process through intermediary organizations like political parties, but also through other organizations like unions or parishes or Kiwanis clubs or what have you, and that those intermediary organizations then help to broaden the sense for individuals that in fact they can aggregate their interests and concerns and engage in the sort of pluralist bargaining that we're much more familiar with today.
So
Can I go ahead. I agree about that, that certainly women, you know, and others were considered to be part of the community, but I think it's also considered by whom is an issue, and people who were excluded. And I think it's notable on the question that you're raising about community and inclusion that the key groups in the revolutionary period and in between 1812 and 1820, which is a critical period, the key groups demanding enfranchisement were people who belonged to the militias, who were fighting in wars and indeed being recruited and semi-compelled to fight in wars, and who were not enfranchised. They were the point people at that period and, in fact, throughout much of American history in demanding the right to vote.
It's hard to remember that white men could once be a group that was outside of the political right, universe. Right. Perhaps that's a valuable point to
right.
keep in mind.
I think that that's an excellent point. And I think that the other point that I forget whether it was Richard or Alex who made this point about the initial mechanics of voting, whereby parties initially were preparing ballots, and that doesn't shift for a while. At the point where you institute the Australian ballot system and you have then the sort of ballots that we're now familiar with, where the state is preparing it, you also have a process where the state is starting to regulate and intervene in the mechanics of voting and, as a consequence, the substance of how the political process manifests itself in ways that you know, create some unexpected changes.
What do you mean? Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, the moment that you start having the state prepare the ballot as opposed to the parties preparing the ballot, now you start having questions about, well, who gets on the ballot? What role does the state have in regulating the parties themselves to make sure that they're doing things properly or fairly? What obligation does the state have towards individual voters with respect to primaries and not just general elections? So now you have a whole state interest that is not just part of that political competition, sort of teams coming together, but you have this referee, the state, that is involved and has responsibilities towards individual voters, and that changes, you know, how I think individual voters think about their particular rights in the political process.
And Gretchen, if I could just jump in and add to that, historians who've studied this period, which is a period between the 1890s and 1920s, have been repeatedly struck by the fact that at just the time when the state intervenes and the modern deliberative kind of League of Women's Voters model of the suffrage becomes more influential and indeed dominant, the percentages of voters, that is to say, voters who could vote, begins to drop. And so that, in fact, as politics becomes less fun, less like a spectator sport, voting becomes what Michael Schudson called something of an act of cognitive challenge, which arguably for many of us, certainly with this case of judges in Illinois, it remains to the present day. And that's a real interesting paradox. The state gets involved, the parties recede, and the number of voters who are individuals who have the right to vote drops.
Well, it seems to me that there's a link here between the right to vote and the notion of equality, which we haven't really talked about by name. But it seems like when you're talking about the period of the founding, you're talking about a pretty hierarchically organized community where, you know, white man head of household will represent his women folk and his children and maybe his slaves if he owns slaves. And so, you know, they were all, quote unquote, represented by him, by his votes, and he had to be represented by him, by his votes, and he had to be represented by his elected official. So at least in somebody's mind, there was this nice hierarchy. And that along with the idea of expanding, letting more people vote, you have a sort of flattening of that hierarchy. And, you know, the idea that nobody's going to be represented by anyone except the person they vote for. Is that okay? Yes, it is an oversimplification, but is it wholly wrong?
Well, I want to jump in, and I'm really curious to hear what Barack and Alex have to say about this, because yes, the age of the founding was an age of hierarchy, and in fact, there were good arguments not to have all, say, white men vote, because some white men were perceived to be dependent, and therefore could in effect be voted by the independent men. But the late 19th and early 20th century is an era of hierarchy, too. It's just a different kind of hierarchy. And in fact, you can make a good argument that with the development of the mass media and the development of the state, that you have a shift and in some ways perhaps even a diminution on the significance of voting. I don't know if I entirely agree with that, but it's certainly a mistake, I think, to say that things get better and better. And that as more people have the right to vote, voting becomes more intrinsically more significant, because there are other mediating institutions, including, of course, today the role of big money in politics.
Significant in what sense?
Well, significant that they can shape who's going to get onto the ballot. Significant in that they can shape what kinds of issues are going to be considered. Significant, as Alex has shown, and it's really marvelous, and it's so beautifully written and clear book, into how the rules are written as to who gets to participate. This was a period, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, in which we have the disfranchisement of large numbers of African Americans in the American South. So it's not a simple story at all.
Alex or Barack?
I'd like to come in on that. And I think I agree completely that there are new hierarchies, and in some ways they're much more raw and more contested in the late 19th and early 20th century. You know, the relationship between native-born elite Protestants in the Northeast and the Midwest, and hundreds of thousands, millions of newly arrived immigrant workers was not one of equality, and it was one that was contested. And a number of these rules that were referred to earlier and that come in, the state's intervention there, although they're presented as being neutral rules promulgated by the state, indeed are designed to limit the voting of the newly arrived and unwashed. One of the, you know, wonderful case studies that I came up with was the registration law passed in Pennsylvania in 1906, which applied only to Pittsburgh. There were a lot of laws like that. They applied only to one particular place. And the minute books of the registration board, which have survived and where they were very open, they cut the size of the electorate of Pittsburgh by 50%, almost entirely in working class and poor wards, and they declared victory when they did that. This was part of a hierarchy whose power was being challenged.
And in the South?
Barack?
Well, I think Alex makes a terrific point, and maybe just to generalize or broaden it a little bit, particularly in the area of voting, oftentimes what is couched as progressive good government reform legislation can end up, and oftentimes is motivated by, exclusionary motivations. And you know, we see that fairly consistently. And when you start getting into, when the Supreme Court starts jumping into these issues around, for example, literacy tests and so forth, one of the interesting tensions is the question that the court has to wrestle with and ultimately resolves in a fairly expansive way, and that is, do you need to qualify to vote in some fashion, or should basically everybody be able to vote? And what are the rules that the state is able to set up that look like objective, neutral tests to prevent fraud or ensure fairness or prevent ballot overcrowding or what have you? Degree of screening is taking place through those mechanisms ends up being a difficult question that we continue to deal with today. We saw it in the contested votes down in Florida.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and also invite some phone calls. We're talking today about the right to vote and its history in this country. We're joined by Barack Obama, who is Illinois State Senator from the 13th District and a senior lecturer in the law school at the University of Chicago. We're also joined by Alex Kasar, professor of history and public policy at Duke University. He's the author of a book called The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in America. And here in the studio, Richard John, associate professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and the author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Navy Pier. Information about the activities and events taking place at the pier this week can be accessed online at www.navypier.com. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Smith Communications, dedicated to creating effective marketing strategies and results-driven advertising for marketers. Information online at smithcommunications.com or at 630-920-5300.
I'm Juan Williams. In his first address to the nation, President Bush will have a big agenda, but at the top of the list is his proposed tax cut. It's gained political support from Republicans and even some Democrats, as well as the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. But government programs will have to be cut to protect the tax plan. So, can the president sell his tax cut? That's the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That's today at 1 o'clock on WBEZ Chicago. You're listening to Odyssey on Chicago Public Radio, 91.5 FM, WBEZ Chicago. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. We're talking today about the right to vote and its evolution over the course of our history. We're joined by Barack Obama, who is an Illinois State Senator from the 13th District. He also teaches at the law school at the U of C. Alex Kasar, who is the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in America. And Richard John, a historian and author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System, from Franklin to Morse. We'll take some calls in a few minutes at 312-832-3124, 312-832-3124. Barack Obama, I wanted to ask you to come back to what we were talking about just before the break. In looking at the 20th century and the place of voting rights and struggles for voting rights in the larger context of the civil rights struggle, is that, as you look at sort of the long sweep of history, is that a strange place for voting rights to be, do you think?
Is what a strange
in the middle of a struggle about civil rights, it seems like what we've been talking about is the fact that it took a while for voting to be seen in that way, to be seen in the context of these other rights and individual liberty.
Well, I think that one of the turning points in thinking about voting and voting rights in this country is explicitly connected to the civil rights movement, and that is the Civil War and the whole issue of enfranchisement following the Civil War and the passage of the 15th Amendment. At that point, you have a very explicit recognition on the part of the Reconstruction Congress that one of the only ways that the newly freed slaves are going to be able, theoretically at least, to protect their interests is to give them some capacity to participate in the political process and make sure that the outcomes of various laws are not to their detriment. And so you then start having, through the 15th Amendment, through various sections of the 14th Amendment, a very explicit recognition that you can't separate political rights or voting rights from civil rights. And you know, as we know from our history, fairly rapidly, the 15th Amendment is rendered basically toothless, in part due to the complicity of the Supreme Court, and it requires then a civil rights movement to reintroduce and reinvigorate that amendment. But I think that fairly early on, there's a recognition within the African-American community that their ability to serve on juries, enforce contracts, protect their property, protect their rights in civil society is going to be to some degree dependent on their ability to participate in the political process.
Okay, this is really an interesting point because if I understand what you're saying, voting was seen with respect to African Americans, voting was seen as a sort of minimal protection that African Americans needed in order to have any leverage with which to enforce other political rights.
The notion that it was preservative of other rights, I think, was understood more acutely by African Americans and their allies than perhaps any other group. And one of the ways to think about it, I guess, is that if in our early history we have a conception of limited government, where most of your rights are going to be protected either by the state, but more importantly by the community, by the fact that you're a majority, that you look like other people who are in power, that you are protected by the norms of the culture and the society, then voting is important, but it's one of many mechanisms where your interests are going to be recognized, represented, and valued.
Do you think
for the African American community, I think that the voting and by extension the government and in particular the federal government is extraordinarily important because these newly free slaves find themselves in an essentially hostile civil society, and it becomes much more important them for them then to be able to actually have representatives and pass laws that are going to provide them with the protection that other portions of the population may be able to take for granted.
Well, now, when you characterize voting that way as this sort of that sort of basic tool that you use to protect your other political rights, that sounds like a pretty modern conception of what voting is about. I mean, that sounds like the way a lot of people talk about that and about why we vote. You know, and you know, if you don't vote, then you just have to live with whatever you end up with because you didn't go and participate, and that's, you're protecting yourself by doing that, that sort of protective notion of voting. But I wonder if that idea was as prominent or there at all with other disenfranchised groups. In other words, did women see the right to vote as essential to the preservation of other rights or immigrants or working class people? Did they see that balance the same way?
I would say that they did. I would say that certainly in the late 19th century and then throughout the 20th century, they did. I mean, one of the critical shifts in the movement for women's suffrage, for example, became the early 20th century alliance between working class women and the suffrage movement, which had been predominantly middle class. And the line of argument there was that to get the laws necessary to protect working class women in the workplace, women had to be enfranchised. One sees, similar things with immigrant workers. It's as Barack mentioned, this is lived very concretely for people. I mean, people experience that the school budgets for their children are very much affected by whether they can vote or not, or what labor laws are like. In the South, in the contested period of the late 19th century, when blacks are enfranchised in certain places, labor laws are rather liberal and give a lot of latitude to African American and other workers on the land or elsewhere. When they are thrown out of politics, you start getting draconian vagrancy laws that says if you're not employed, you know, if you're basically not working as a sharecropper for a local merchant or a local landowner, you can be arrested. I mean, this is all lived very concretely, and in the North as well. They you know, where streetcar lines were going to go, what kinds of services you got, whether you got any kind of sewage treatment in your neighborhood was affected by whether or not your group was enfranchised.
Richard John?
Well, I, Alex, I just was going to ask you a question, because, of course, it, as is well known, a number of women's rights activists in the 1860s and 70s said this is the Negro's hour, that is to say that they would not press for their own suffrage and they would promote and support the 15th Amendment. So that, at least at that point in time, I think it was Lucy Stone, those women believed that their rights, at least relative to those of African Americans, would be better protected in the kinds of ways that Barack, I think, so well laid out for us. And I wondered if you'd speak to the tension within the women's movement about this African American suffrage.
Well, I think there were several different strands in the women's movement even at that time. I mean, because there was also Elizabeth Cady Stanton saying very clearly, you know, that women would walk into the polling booths on the arm of the uniformed black soldier. And there was an expectation on part of many women that they would be enfranchised. I think that the perspective that this is the Negro's hour, in fact, which was certainly present, was more of a male perspective, both black and white. I mean, Frederick Douglass, Wendell Phillips, it was said, you know, African Americans need the protection much more than women do, and probably that was the case in the 1860s and the 1870s. And for the remainder of the movement for women's suffrage, the tension continued over alliances in the North with immigrants and in the South with blacks. The movement for women's suffrage in the South remained pretty conservative on the question of enfranchisement of blacks. I mean, one of the arguments that was made was you should enfranchise women because there are more white women than there are black men and women combined. So women's suffrage will guarantee white supremacy.
I want to take some calls in just a minute, but Alex Kesar, I want to get at least one point in before we do that, and that comes from your book. People are pretty familiar, I assume, with, you know, the struggle for the women's right to vote, with the story of the Civil War and black suffrage. But you talk about in your book the link between two other factors and the expansion and contraction of the franchise, and those are war, and specifically military service, and class. Can you, in just a short amount of time, address those giant subjects?
Oh, certainly. I can boil that down to 10 seconds each. What I argue in the book, and I think is true, is that it is military service and the need to fight wars, and sometimes the ideological component of that provides the single largest impetus to expand the right to vote. It is very difficult to mobilize the popular support of people in war or get them to go into the army if they are disfranchised. I mean, one sees that, and sometimes it's a reward. But I mean, every major expansion of the franchise in American history occurs during or immediately after a war, and that's not a coincidence. And as recently as the era of the Civil Rights Movement, you know, the first critical step in enlarging the black franchise took place during World War II and was linked to the question of black soldiers who were numerous in World War II. And the Cold War put tremendous ideological pressure on the United States to enfranchise its black population. Class, I think, runs in the other direction. I mean, what I think I have detected in looking at this long sweep of history is that the fundamental resistance to expanding the franchise comes from class tensions, and thus there are more parallels between what happens in the South and in the North than I think we have previously understood. There are many attempts to limit and restrict the political power of working class people and poor people in a lot of different economic and social settings. And, you know, I alluded to this case before, these remarkable movement in the 1930s, which is successful in some places to disfranchise the unemployed, building on long-standing laws in many states that people who were considered paupers could not vote. And that remains a part of American law until the 1960s. It is only in 1966 that the Supreme Court rules that, in the language of the decision, that wealth was not germane to the right to vote.
All right, let's take some phone calls at 312-832-3124. 312-832-3124 is our number. Let's talk with Ben. Good morning, Ben. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It seems to me that age as a criteria for voting has served a significant purpose and a legitimate purpose throughout the years in measuring competence and as a substitute for intelligence. But since the 70s, when mentally retarded adults began to become enfranchised, to today, when MR adults are basically across the board eligible voters, hasn't the idea that age serves as a legitimate substitute for competence or intelligence gone by the wayside? And don't we need to revisit this question to bring it more into line with our practices?
All right, we haven't really talked about age. That's an interesting dimension. Alex Kisar, do you want to address that?
Sure. It is used as a proxy for being reasonable. And for most of our history, it's 21, and then it changes to 18. And I think, indeed, that's another case of a war and military mobilization related process. I mean, it happens. It also happens in a very awkward and complicated and slightly accidental legal way. But it's reduced to 18. I think that the issue of people mentally retarded is a somewhat different one. It's to say that those people really have an interest and a stake, that they want to be able to protect their own rights. Now, if you're talking about revisiting it by saying people younger than age 18, I suppose a case could be made for that. Certainly my teenage daughter would make that case. And I don't think it's likely to happen very soon. I mean, among other things, the argument for moving it down to 18 was that 18 was the age at which you could be drafted into the military, and thus you should be able to vote.
Richard or Barack, you want to add anything?
Well, you know, I think what Ben may be getting at is that when you drop the age, when you set the age limit at 18, the presumption is that the 17-year-old somehow is not sufficiently mature to participate. And I suppose that there has been a shift, at least in terms of Supreme Court doctrine, that would suggest a court's perspective the court moving away from some notion that being literate or being civically informed or being intelligent, anything like that, should in any way restrict the franchise. And if that's the case, I suppose you could argue that choosing 18 as opposed to 17 and a half is an arbitrary number. I don't think that age restrictions end up being quite as controversial, at least when we're outside the context of war, once we've reached a certain threshold where if you can be drafted, then you're able to vote. Because I think everybody assumes, well, at some point I'm going to get to be 18 and I can vote. So you're not dealing with the sorts of immutable characteristics like race or gender that, you know, potentially might burden you across time.
All right, Richard John, did you want to add something?
Well, I mean, it is a really interesting question. Alex has pointed out quite rightly that voters are voting on issues that are of a great personal moment, and certainly education is an issue that's at the very center of our political debate. We would assume that, let us say, junior high and high schoolers, if not perhaps even sixth graders, have a strong views on education, and we might see a slightly different educational policy if they were enfranchised. This is one realm in which the idea that certain individuals, that is parents, stand in for children, even though children are part of the community, lives on.
Right. And it persists. And I think that's you are raising a good point, Richard, and that is that this is something that all politicians are aware of, is that seniors vote and kids don't. And so what is certainly true is that you, as a consequence of those age restrictions, you end up having a skewing of political power and policy towards the elderly and away from children, even though they might be equally vulnerable. And you also see these kinds of issues coming up in questions, for example, of under the Voting Rights Act, how do we measure population for purposes of districting? Should we use a voting age population, or should we use a total population? A voting age population might end up punishing those communities that are disproportionately young.
All right, let's take some more phone calls at 312-832-3124. Let's talk to Joanne. Good morning, Joanne. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I was speaking to my father the other day, and he made me aware that not every society has been, whether it's a right to vote, but some have been, it's mandated by law that you vote. For instance, ancient Greece and current-day Australia, there is no such thing as what was the voter turnout. It's 100%. And the idea being that you cannot get a true representation of what the people want unless you hear from everyone. And it sounds like a good idea to me. I'm curious to hear what you think.
All right. This is a, maybe we can also tag on to that, the question of how voting, in terms of right, obligation, duty, those sorts of things, how that view of voting varied at different times. Alex Kesar?
Well, it's the idea of making voting compulsory, you know, that if it was a right and that it was also your duty to vote. And the idea of making it compulsory has really been around for a while, and there were some, again, fairly significant movements among state legislatures and state constitutional conventions to make voting compulsory, especially in the early 20th century, in the teens. And in fact, actually, even in Chicago, there was a significant exploration of this. One of the issues that always came up around that was, well, what did you do to somebody who didn't vote? What was the sanction you imposed? You know, did you not let them vote next time? That seemed to go in the opposite direction. and that issue really, really bedeviled this. I think the other thing, at least the way I would characterize the history, is that the movements to make voting mandatory have usually come from partisan or semi-partisan quarters. In the progressive era and in the 1920s, for example, it really came from people who feared that the machines were turning out their voters in large numbers, but good, respectable middle-class citizens weren't bothering to vote. And it generally has a thrust of, we want to make our people vote, not necessarily everybody vote. I would love to see turnout greatly increased. I'm dubious about whether making voting mandatory would be the way to do it.
Barack or Richard?
You know, I am not sure that we wouldn't have a healthier political process if we had mandatory voting of the sort that they have in Australia. As I understand it, I think you're looking at a modest fine in Australia for not voting. So at least there's some incentive to vote beyond, you know, civic interest or involvement. And I'm not sure that wouldn't be a healthy thing. I don't think it's a realistic prospect because it runs contrary to a strong libertarian ethos in this country that, you know, I think applies to voting like everything else. I don't get a sense that this country, I think most individuals feel that voting's a good thing. It's part of our civic responsibility. But I think they also feel like, you know, if I want to sit on the couch and watch the XFL and not go to the polls, then that's okay too. There's a strong dose of skepticism about mandating voting that I think could not be overcome in this country.
Do I detect an anti-XFL bias in you, Barack Obama?
No comment.
Okay.
I just like to add one more thing on this. I think that one could at least argue, and I might be inclined to argue, that, and this is on a question of realism that was just referred to, that in fact the major political parties today have no particular interest in increasing turnout.
That's right. One of the things that we haven't spoken about, but I think Richard's raising an excellent point, is that one of the tricky aspects of tinkering with voting laws is that whoever's in power, whoever controls the mechanisms of the state, obviously did pretty good under the current voting rules. And so, there's a strong bias towards the status quo and inertia when it comes to voting arrangements.
Richard John?
Well, I've just been thinking about responsibilities that are required and that you pay a fine if you don't fulfill them. And I was thinking of jury duty. I mean, it's interesting that we don't think of voting as more like jury duty. If you don't go to jury when you're called up, you are subject to a fine. Presumably, perhaps, I don't know what the laws are, something more severe.
Don't you think that's sort of a historical accident, though, Richard, in the sense that if you polled the average person and they didn't understand jury duty in that fashion, and you just asked them sort of what would be the ideal jury arrangement, it'd be interesting to say whether they would think it should be mandatory as opposed to voluntary.
Yeah, that might well be. I'm not sure you'd have juries.
Exactly, which is a problem, right?
If that were the case.
You'd have even lower turnout than you do on Election Day.
Mm. All right, let's take some more calls. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Alan. Good morning, Alan. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi, this is kind of an amorphous, murky two-part question, and I hope it makes sense. Over the last 10 or 15 years, I've probably read two or three articles that have advanced the position that it's been part and parcel of Republican national, state, and local election strategy and tactics to do what can be done in means both subtle and unsubtle to discourage turnout and keep the turnout down, because in large measure, the lower the turnout, the better Republicans do. And that ties in with the draconian laws in a lot of the Republican-dominated states that prevent people with one felony conviction on their record from voting. And this particularly came to the fore in Florida, where over 500,000 people are disenfranchised because of this, most of them minorities. And as Salon.com has reported, the private firm that was hired by Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris removed about 8,000 people from the rolls who supposedly had felony convictions, when it turned out only about 6,500 of them did. So I'd be interested in your comments on that.
All right. Who'd like to respond?
Oh, I can do. I think there are two parts to it. I think that, on the whole, it is the case that the Republicans have sought lower turnout. But I think it's really the case that both parties seek to turn out their own, and in situations where lower turnout will advantage them, they will press for it. I mean, I don't. There's a certain demographic bias in favor of the Democratic Party that would lead you to think that higher turnout will benefit them, but it's really a question of who turns out, not overall turnout. On the question of felons, what I think was remarkably revealed in the Florida case was how deliberately the Republicans organizing in Florida set about to enforce the felon disfranchisement laws for partisan purposes. I thought that was very striking.
Mm-hmm. I think it was troubling. I think that Alex's point is right on target, that although Republicans, because of some of the class issues that we've already discussed, I think Republicans feel that generally a low turnout election will advantage them, although that's not always the case. And I don't think that's because Republicans are necessarily more venal than Democrats. I think it's a matter of who you think your constituents are. Which does raise one thing that we haven't touched on, and I know we're running out of time, Gretchen, but I think is important when we think about the right to vote, at least with respect to the Supreme Court and how we think about this legally. One of the major shifts that takes place is the one person, one vote revolution in the early 60s. And the reason that that's so important is because, at least in terms of legal theory, you start getting a conception that the importance of voting is not simply going to the polls and casting your ballot, not just access to voting. It also involves a meaningful vote. The Supreme Court, for the first time in the cases first Baker versus Carr and then Reynolds versus Sims, what the Supreme Court says is, you know, if you haven't districted properly so that everybody's vote basically weighs equally, then we're going to force you to redistrict. A huge political revolution that affects just about every state in the union in the early 60s. What that does is it opens up the door for various people to come before the Supreme Court saying, you know what, our vote is not meaningful because our vote is being submerged. We're a minority group, and this is an at-large voting system. And so we're not able to ever elect candidates of our choice. And that leads then down the path of creation of majority-minority districts, notions that start approaching ideas of proportional representation. And I think that's been a major shift that we're still struggling with today.
Well, we just have about a minute left, but let me just ask you to project forward, if you will, Barack. Are there particular fronts on which you think the right to vote is likely to evolve?
Well, I think that one of the questions that the Supreme Court is going to have to settle, and I think is a reflection of our times as well, is how do we feel about ideas like proportional representation or concepts like cumulative voting that give you proportional representation without sort of the artificial, some of the artificial mechanisms that might imply? Because we have an increasingly diverse, increasingly complex pluralistic society, and people's expectations that there are people like them in the corridors of power representing them, I think, is heightened in ways that it might have not have been earlier. That comes into tension with all kinds of other concepts that the Supreme Court thinks about, like colorblindness and so forth.
We'll have to get to those another day. Barack Obama is Illinois State Senator from the 13th District and a senior lecturer in the law school at the University of Chicago. Alex Kasar is professor of history and public policy at Duke University and the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in America. Richard John is associate professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the author of Spreading the News, The American Postal System from Franklin to Morse. Thank you all very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Thanks to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing. Thanks to Steve Bynum and Veronica Williams for engineering. Worldview is up next. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.